The following is a production of University Laboratory High School and Illinois Public Media.
There's all this poverty in the Delta, but there's no real logical explanation for it other than that it's been intentionally orchestrated by white planters over the years. The soil is outstanding there, and so there's plenty of great crops, and there's great opportunities to make good commerce and to be successful, but sharecropping was basically a failed form of slavery that was put in place by the planters because they already had control and they were able to continue to exercise that control. And that's even carried on today, even though we don't have sharecropping. The family wealth, the privilege, you know, has continued to be passed down.
Shingle by shingle, I'm patching up the roof. Row by row, I'm bringing in the crop.
The Mississippi Delta is a land of extreme contrasts. Its fields are rich and bountiful. However, despite the wealth of the region as a whole, many of its people live in extreme poverty. This is due to longstanding patterns of economic exploitation, political disenfranchisement, and racial segregation. In the wake of the modern civil rights movement, organizations such as Habitat for Humanity took root in the Delta. They sought to combat deep-seated poverty by improving access to decent, affordable housing, better education, and broader economic opportunities.
But what we do with Habitat is we adopt a family, not just to get a house, but to involve them. I mean, they're not just given a house, what's called sweat equity. They work themselves, and their friends work on the house. And you get to know them. And so what we do with the Habitat families is we surround them with love as we're in the process of surrounding them with walls.
I was working at a convenience store, and when Matt and Rachel walked in and they told me you've been approved, I waited until they left and I just started screaming all over the place. And then I realized there were cameras everywhere. I said, oh, hold on, I gotta quit this and everything. But it was awesome. The feeling was absolute awesome, just awesome. I can't explain the joy that bubbled up inside of me. I try to explain it, but words can't describe it. Just knowing that you're building a house that will one day become yours, it's worth it all.
It restores the dignity to our black men, women, children. Do you know what? Let me say this, and I say this proudly. At Sherrod School, all of the children down here from elementary on, what was getting bad grades are now on honor roll. That, to me, within itself speaks a lot. You have their own room where they can go to and get their lesson and concentrate. They can invite their friends over because they are not ashamed of where they stay. So once you restore a person's dignity back to them, it makes a whole different person.
As the work of Habitat and other organizations gained momentum, volunteers from other regions, including the Midwest, have journeyed to the Delta. They have done so not only out of a concern to remedy socioeconomic disparities, but also out of a desire for spiritual growth or a deeper sense of purpose in life. Since the mid-1990s, a steady stream of people affiliated with various churches and schools in East Central Illinois have developed long-term relationships with people and communities in the Mississippi Delta by working within local organizations to bring about sustainable change. To explore the history of these connections, University Laboratory High School students interviewed longtime Mississippi residents, community leaders, and volunteers working with Habitat for Humanity and other community development organizations in the Delta. We proudly present their stories in Rebuilding Foundations, Housing and Hope in the Mississippi Delta. I'm Andrew Stelzer.
I'm Anne-Marie Michael.
And I'm Carissa Hu.
Love makes a change, I'm living the proof. New waters in the well and I'm grateful for every drop.
Decades of slavery, followed by further economic exploitation through sharecropping and segregation, resulted in vast racial disparities in wealth and opportunity. History teacher Bill Sutton explains the origin of these conditions following the Civil War.
When the military phase of the war ends in April of 1865, almost immediately another struggle begins. The result of that struggle is that the freedmen and women will be, to a certain extent, returned to this level of exploitable, controllable labor through a system known as sharecropping. So the plantation owner owns the land, the plantation owner provides food at a cost to the sharecroppers while they're planting and tending and harvesting the crop. And when the crop comes in, then they share the profits. But the landowner gets to do all the figuring, and the landowner gets to charge whatever the landowner wants to for those supplies that the sharecroppers, you know, are completely dependent upon during the time of raising the crops. Really, the point of it is to, is to keep the white landowners in charge. And they are not shy about saying that.
Dorothy Jenkins grew up in the Mississippi Delta. She recalls her family's experiences with sharecropping.
Well, in the sharecropping, your parents would rent land from the owner, and you would work the fields. It depended if you was a renter, or you could sell your cotton, but you didn't get the full price of it that he was gonna get when he sold it. This was all back to unfair labor. Every fourth bale that you picked would be his, along with you having to pay rent on the property that you was renting.
The plantation owner just had to make sure that the workers were able to work. But there was absolutely no sense of you work hard and you get to advance. And most of the housing was owned by the plantation owners. So you would live where you needed to live to be available to the plantation owner for what they wanted you to do.
Jackie Byes, another Mississippi native, shares her firsthand experience growing up in the poor conditions of landowner-provided homes.
They didn't have no foundation. They would sit up on like four big stones and the house is set there. No, we didn't have a toilet. Yeah, they called it the outhouse. Like wake up in the middle of the night and go to the bathroom and kind of sit out in the middle of nowhere. And so when we finally got one, I think my daddy boss man finally gave him a TV. And then we finally got a swing. My daddy pretty much took care of the house itself, like building it. Taking care of it.
In addition to the exploitative sharecropping system, the legal restrictions commonly known as Jim Crow laws were enforced from the 1870s until the 1960s. Bill Sutton and Mississippi native Patrick Weems explain.
The Jim Crow system, it's a legal system, it's an economic system, it's a political system, and it's a social system. It is all-encompassing, and the entire point of it is to keep black people in a subordinate situation. Economically, it looks like later on unwillingness to extend loans or mortgages to black businessmen or landowners. Politically, it results in complete disenfranchisement through this ingenious strategy called the literacy tests, which allow white registrars to pass judgment on anybody who's trying to register to vote, and any black person that's trying to register to vote has to answer these questions about the Mississippi State Constitution that turn out to be either impossible to answer or the registrar just unilaterally declares the answer wrong.
It wasn't until the 60s that African Americans got the vote in Mississippi, but there was still a lot of voter intimidation. I've heard stories of people being at polls with their trucks with guns in the back of it to try to intimidate black voters from voting or intimidate them into voting for a specific person. And so on top of that, there was gerrymandering. So they set up districts in a way that ensured that white people would win.
Jim Crow laws were only one component of the white supremacist system in place. Bill Foster, who grew up in Chicago and spent summers with family in Mississippi, recalls the unspoken social norms of the South.
The kids knew how to act in the presence of white people because that was always a subject that they harped on. You know, you don't do certain things with white people. White women, you stay as far away from them as possible. Being a black, especially a black male, you were taught. It was drilled into you, you know, how to react to white people. If they ask you a question, yes, sir, no, sir, or you didn't raise your eyes, they look him straight in his eyes.
Carl Fuller, who grew up in Georgia, shares his similar experiences with the segregation and implicit hierarchies he observed as a youth.
Blacks knew their place in the South. You were a product of the colored and the white water fountains. When you're traveling, you were always asked, where's the colored town? And because you know that's where you belong.
Fuller goes on to describe the segregation of the school systems, yet another measure taken by white supremacists in order to prohibit the advancement of black people.
All the schools during that era and period of time was segregated. Whites went to, on the west side, their schools. The blacks, we had our schools. And the one thing that really bothered me more than anything else was we always received the hand-me-down books. You could see the different kids that signed their names, but it was better than nothing. And so many pulled themselves up through that education system. The teachers was committed. The principals was committed.
As life became increasingly unbearable for African Americans in the South, the so-called Great Migration began in the early 20th century. Many black people from the Mississippi Delta moved to northern cities like Chicago and Detroit. Bill Foster explains what led many members of his family to leave the South.
Once they got to the city, they got jobs and they sent for the other relatives. So eventually they all migrated. My family moved first in 1945. We moved to Chicago. The others moved in 1955. Once we moved to Chicago, there were a lot of jobs then at that time, laborers. So you didn't have to have an education or anything. All you needed was a strong back. So we made it fairly well. There were factory jobs in Chicago. We had the stockyards for people without an education. There was much more that they could do then than now. Life was better up north.
As black people moved to northern cities, many white people moved to the suburbs, maintaining racial segregation. Again, Bill Foster.
Shakespeare was the name of the school that I went to. When I went there in 1954, it was about 80% white. The very next semester, it had completely changed. It was 80% black. The whole dynamics of the school changed. And they were from families like myself that had migrated north. And naturally, white people were moving to the suburbs.
Even after the civil rights movement of the 1950s and 60s ended legal segregation, many communities remained segregated due to continued racism and generational poverty. For Willie Williams, who grew up in the Mississippi Delta, racial segregation was a given.
In the 60s, the South were pretty much segregated, the schools and everything. The whites stayed in a different area than the black. Even though we was in the same neighborhood, but we stayed in a different area. Segregation was one of those things that was just the way of life in the South in the early, late 60s.
Due to longstanding discrimination in education and housing, black communities in the Delta face disproportionate levels of poverty. Delta residents Ben Williams and James Jackson share their experiences of striving to make ends meet.
Even though we were poor, I didn't know that we were poor because there were a lot of other people around us that was just like me. It was not uncommon to see someone build a fire in the front yard just to cook. One of my favorite ones was this, it's a weed they call peppergrass. I had no idea what we were doing. But I was following the rest of the kids when Grandma would say, go get us some mess of peppergrass. So we would go out into the field and we would pull this weed 4 or 5 hours. It took really that long to get enough to eat. So, and she would come home and she would just strip all the leaves off these little stalks and just cook it, and it tasted so good.
We used to load up in a station wagon and on the back of a truck and go chop cotton. Chop cotton, those that are not familiar with it, is it going along the rows and chopping the grass or the weeds away from the cotton. We would load that truck down so much, or that station wagon so low, that the struts were struggling because of so many people. That was another way of us getting money as a, coming up as a kid, because we did not have that money. We was on food stamps all of my life, all of my life. So it was normal to receive financial assistance from the government.
Emily Wisseman, who works with young adults in the Delta, describes how deeply rooted racial disparities affect today's youth.
You look at the history of the place, this was the heart of slavery and the heart of sharecropping. And there are parents of students that we have that grew up in sharecropper families where they were not allowed to get an education. Where if you got an education or tried to, you were kicked off the plantation. So that wasn't that long ago. It's as well, it used to be before cotton farming was mechanized that anyone could at least get a job in the field. And then you have that turned into four or five guys hired to run machines for thousands of acres, and they just don't need very many people. So then you have this uneducated class of people that has had slavery, sharecropping, education is completely not in their family, left in the world in an area with very few jobs because all the cotton farming jobs are gone, and then told that you should care about school. It's just gonna take generations to undo that. There was this great wrong done, this great inequality, and you can't just like flip it on its head and expect it to change right away.
Faith has often been a source of hope and strength in dealing with these societal injustices. Dorothy Jenkins explains how her faith has helped her and her family.
We were very religious. We always believed in God. Now, we grew up knowing and studying the Bible, and most of all, to learn to forgive and love. Because, you know, that was during the Civil Rights Movement and all of that. So we was always taught that you cannot move forward with tomorrow until you forget about what happened yesterday. We was coming out of the slavery age. To survive, you had to keep a clear mind.
David and Abby Warfel, Illinois residents who worked in Mississippi in the 1990s, recall what they observed about the faith of African Americans they met in the Delta.
Ulysses Carter was still living in Clarksdale, so he would tell stories about how the plantation owner met with his dad at the end of the year and said, "You didn't earn any money this year." And his dad, brave enough, would say, "Well, I think maybe this amount." And the owner said, "Oh, well, actually, I just don't care. I got a son to send to college, and that's where my money's going." When students would say, but how could you tolerate that? How could you put up with that? And Ulysses just would smile, and he would say, "Because you know what? They're both dead now, and my daddy's in heaven, and that man's burning in hell." And I was like, wow, that's a different kind of God than the one I grew up with. But it makes a whole lot of sense in that setting, religiously.
Specifically, people like Dorothy Jenkins had a faith that was, you know, almost necessary for survival, but in such a beautiful way, mm-hmm. and genuine way. Mm-hmm. They would thank God for, you know, at the beginning of one of the common things they would say in prayers, you know, "We just want to thank you, God, for waking us up this morning." You didn't have to do that, but you woke us, like, it's a gift to wake up in the morning.
Somebody out there's got to listen, yeah. Somebody out there's got to know what I'm talking about. Raise your hand if you're with me. There's hope in a hopeless world. Looking for a hope.
The Mississippi Delta was not the only place where poverty persisted in the midst of material riches. Entrenched socioeconomic inequalities were evident across the U.S. In the 1970s, a novel approach to bridging the gap between haves and have-nots took shape within a small Christian community called Koinonia Farm in Georgia. Millard and Linda Fuller, who had lived for several years on Koinonia Farm, formed Habitat for Humanity in 1976. The intent was to bring together low-income individuals in material need and affluent individuals in spiritual need in the shared project of creating affordable housing. Habitat homes were simple, well-built, and affordable, thanks to the use of volunteer labor and no-interest loans. While substandard housing was a problem around the globe, the legacy of economic exploitation made the need for decent housing particularly urgent in the Mississippi Delta. As Bill Sutton explains,
one of the foundational principles was this idea of partnering together. So this is not a handout, this is not a charity, this is justice, mercy, grace, working together to provide livable housing. The homeowners are required to put in a certain amount of what they call sweat equity, 400 hours of working on their own homes, working with Habitat, working on somebody else's home. The way it worked in the Delta, because so much of the substandard housing was also black housing, this whole process provided for a really significant reconciliation dynamic between volunteers who are predominantly white and homeowners who are predominantly black, actually like working together.
Otto Prius, a founding member of the first Habitat affiliate in West Tallahatchie County, recounts how the organization took shape in the Delta.
In 1984, Butch East, a Methodist minister at the church I was going to, he and I were talking about the different organizations and what good they did or didn't do. He said, you know, I think I know something that might be interesting. It's called Habitat for Humanity. So we had a meeting in April, I think it was 84, because it was somewhere around there, June, that we eventually evolved into the first Habitat in Mississippi. We had predominantly white people involved, one or two blacks. I told Butch that I thought we needed to get some more blacks involved because it was looking like we were a bunch of benevolent whites. I didn't want that to be. And if we're going to work at this, it needed to be a participation of both races.
Besides the challenge of racial integration, Habitat faced opposition initially because it was seen as an outside organization. Again, Otto Prius.
We were trying to incorporate and start doing something in the town of Webb. The people of Webb, not all of them, but a lot of them, signed a petition against us. They didn't know what it was all about. It's just a foreign organization coming in, butting up against the traditions of how things were done. So we could have done something about that. We had lawyers from everywhere wanting to sue. And I said, if we do that, we will destroy Habitat before we get it off the ground. I said, if you try and condemn the people of the community, then you are never going to have any support.
Ora Lee Johnson, the first owner of a Habitat house in the Delta, tells about the obstacles faced in the process of finding a place to build her house.
The first area, they turned us down. Webb just flat out turned us down. So we went to Frank Michener.
Michener was a local white landowner who was known to be fair to African Americans who worked on his extensive land holdings.
I had worked there so long, and he found out what a hard time they were having trying to get a lot for me. He donated it to Habitat so that I could have a place to live.
Longtime employees appealing to white landowners for property on which to build houses was not uncommon in the Delta. In addition to land, volunteer labor was another scarce resource. To resolve this problem, Habitat District Administrator Luther Millsaps proposed an imaginative solution, as former Habitat board member Millsaps Dye recalls.
15 miles down the road from there is Parchman, the state penitentiary. Luther is the kind that, if it hadn't been done, Luther says, well, let's try it. He went down, he knew, had some connections, he somehow got permission for volunteers to come from the penitentiary and provided some of the first labor for the first house, Habitat, in Mississippi.
Ora Lee Johnson had been sharing a rental property with extended family. She explains the difference that it made for her children to finally have a home of their own.
I was there with my three girls and my parents and two grandparents. We all lived in the same house. I needed to get out. It has made a big difference in my life, having my own house. Because previously, when I lived with my mom, it was no way my children could have sleepovers or anything like that because the house was full. It was literally filled to the brim. I wanted my children to have a life, and I wanted them to be able to have friends over and to do things that just normal kids do. When we got to my house, my children had the freedom of having friends and having sleepovers, and for some reason, my house became the community house. It has made a tremendous difference in my children's lives. All of my children finished college. A lot of kids didn't do that. Two of them are working on their master's, so I think it was because we had that house, and we had all of this love going on within the house.
Come to me now, to me, rest your head for just 5 minutes.
The need for housing continued to grow, especially as the mechanization of farming intensified. Employers were no longer obligated to provide housing for the workers they had replaced. As a result, by the late 1980s, Habitat had expanded to Delta communities beyond West Tallahatchie County. In 1989, a Habitat affiliate was established in the small settlement of Cahoma. Its success inspired residents in the tiny hamlets of Farrell and Sherrod to create another affiliate in the mid-1990s. Dorothy Jenkins, who spearheaded the process in Farrell-Sherrod, recalls the persistence required to become a registered affiliate.
At that time, you had local administrators, and I was district administrators. Ours was from Tupelo, which was Luther Millsap. If you sent in your application, if it was accepted, he was the one that would take it into Habitat International, and they would see if you meet the requirement. Naturally, we were accepted, but not because we came up to code, but because we were so determined. They said they'd never had affiliated a community with no resources and as small as ours, that we would be a liability, but we proved to be an asset because of the determination. You see, we had built our first house 75% before we were affiliated. That's just how determined we were. So when Luther Millsap carried our application in, they said, no way. They don't have no resources out there. They are not incorporated. And this is just somebody out across the field. You know, and Habitat is nationwide. So to look at a little community, and then Ms. Sherrod came aboard, and that's why it's Farrell Sherrod Habitat. You got two communities combined. All of these houses down here, the land was donated by him.
The provision of low-cost, simple, but decent housing for their former employees through Habitat was, of course, ultimately in the interests of the landowners, like the Sherrods.
If you would have seen some of the houses that these down here came out of, compared to the houses now, Jack Shedd or Miss Maggie could ride by and say, just look what we gave, and now this is the way they are living.
In addition to the support from the rich landowners, the community's continued drive to make Farrell Sherrod an official affiliate propelled them forward. Millsap's Dye was helping to coordinate volunteer work for various Habitat affiliates in Cahoma County in the 1990s. He recalls another aspect of the Farrell Sherrod group's ingenuity.
Some people from the Farrell Sherrod community, Dorothy Jenkins and some others, so they started building a Habitat house. There was a problem. They didn't have a Habitat affiliate. They were just building this house, and they were telling people, we're building a Habitat house. Well, Habitat officials somewhere heard about it, and they said, well, they can't do that. So they sent somebody down. Dorothy and some of them found out they were coming, so they said, oh, that's great, man, we love Habitat. So So they had a potluck supper to greet this representative who they didn't know at the time, but was coming to shut them down. And all the people in the community came. They met one of the other churches around and sang songs. And then when they closed, and everybody joins hands, and Dorothy starts singing, "Amazing." And everybody joins in singing "Amazing Grace." So this Habitat guy went back, and they said, "Well, did you shut him down?" He said, "Well, not yet. I'm working on it, though." After about the fourth person they sent to close them down came back and said, "I think it's going to be easier to just give them an affiliate than to shut them down."
Father alone, we know all about it. Father alone, we will understand why. Cheer up, my brother, live in the sun. We'll understand it all by and by.
As a result of Farrell Sherrod's initiative, more affiliates sprung up nearby. Danielle Miller, a hardworking mother of three, lives in a Habitat home in the Delta. She describes the many advantages it offers to her and to her children.
Where I was living, it wasn't the best of conditions, but I needed a place for me and my children to stay. I was living in a place where I didn't have air or heat. I had water from the abandoned apartment behind me. When it rained in the apartment, the water would seep up under and come into my bedroom. You have people paying $300, $400, or $500 to live in something that need to be torn down. But because they need a place to stay, they pay that rent. And then they have people that have the Habitat house, some of them are even paying $100. The beginning Habitat houses, the highest they pay over there is $90, $93 in a mortgage. That's a help to us. That extra money can go towards some other things. Better car to get you back and forth to work. You're able to not have to worry about really taking care of your kids on the income that you do have. And then, like I say, it's the people that you meet, because when they come into your life, they're in your life. Every year they come. They knocking on your door, checking on you. And that right there says a lot. They saw something in you, the Habitat community, the board members, and then blessed you with a quality home.
Habitat board member Willie Williams has witnessed people's gratitude as they receive a house that they and others have worked for.
We just had a house dedication a couple weeks ago, and this lady had applied for 4 times. Just to have the house dedication, to give her her hammer and give her her Bible, and to see her cry and see everybody cry. Yeah, it's so powerful. You know, sometimes people would take it for granted that, you know, most of us have decent homes and stuff like that. And just your heart is filled with compassion. Sometimes when you see the living condition that some of these people. And it's in your own neighborhood. You don't even know about it. So it's just been such a blessing for me to have a small portion in being involved in something that is so bigger than an individual or an organization. Just to give people hope that people do care.
In addition to providing decent and affordable housing, Habitat has enabled people to take steps towards the goal of racial reconciliation. In places marked by a history of stark inequality and racial violence, the sight of increasingly diverse volunteers working together on a Habitat construction site is particularly striking, as Pastor James Jackson points out.
Every time Habitat came down, or you guys came down from your banner, I thought it was really neat that I see a group of whites. Most of the time it was white. It was a few blacks, but the majority of the time it was white coming down a black neighborhood. And it kept reaffirming to me that the past is the past. We got whites that really care. We had so many whites that got involved and that kind of motivated. This, I like this. I could work with this.
I could last for long, but now I think I'm able to carry on. It's been a long time coming, but I know change gonna come. Oh, yes it will.
the 1990s, Cahoma County had several Habitat affiliates. But as the number of affiliates grew, the need for more resources, especially volunteer workers, also increased. The problem of finding volunteer workers for Habitat sites in the Delta inspired an experiment in the small, all-Black hamlet of Cahoma, Mississippi. According to Millsaps Dye, two men, Cahoma Mayor Washington Jones and Habitat District Administrator Luther Millsaps, deserve credit for finding this creative solution.
Mayor Jones got to talking about housing need. He said, I know you're doing this Habitat. Said, can't we build some houses in Cahoma? We need them. Well, the traditional answer would have been no, because the kind of the formula in Habitat was that you need 25,000 population minimum to host and have a Habitat affiliate. So the answer to the mayor from 330 people community was no. But he was talking to Luther Millsaps, who said, well, I don't think they've done that. Let's see if we can't work that out. Now, Luther would watch the news and read the papers, and he knew spring break came. He said, these kids, they want to go somewhere. I believe they're college students, that if we would put it out as an invitation, they would come work. And there was an international Habitat newsletter at that time. He said, well, let's just put an invitation. They put out an invitation. There were 400 and something responses. And they spread them out as best they could, not only in Cahoma and Farrell, Sherrod, and Clarksdale, but Collegiate Challenge is now a strong part of Habitat International all over the world.
In the meantime, awareness of Habitat for Humanity's work grew. Faith communities across the country started to support the organization's mission by providing volunteer work crews. In Champaign-Urbana, New Covenant Fellowship, a non-denominational church, had historically been committed to helping people in need as a way of putting their faith into action. Bill Sutton had been one of these young people in search of a spiritual connection who started the church in the mid-1970s. He recalls some of the social justice-oriented work that the church engaged in.
There was this guy at New Covenant named Marty Shupak. He was the one who, more than anybody, had this vision that if you're going to follow Jesus, you're going to have to be about social justice and you're going to have to put your heart into it. So there was this real hunger, I think, to see God's justice more manifested in the society around us and the culture around us.
In the early 1990s, the congregation of New Covenant began to seek new ways to help a broader range of people. But as many of the congregants by then had children, they were also looking for ways to involve their kids. Fortunately, Habitat for Humanity was looking for more volunteers in their Collegiate Challenge program. Again, Bill Sutton.
Some member of New Covenant had heard about this and contacted the Linders and said this might be something that New Covenant really could do. They'd have to bring some college students because it's got to be Collegiate Challenge, but I think that they would be open to if you brought some college students and some families.
Jane Sutton, Bill's wife, recalls her reaction when she heard about the proposed trip to Mississippi.
At the time, we were married and we had a 4-year-old, a 7-year-old, and a 10-year-old. We went to church one morning and Barb Linder got up and said that they had found a community in Mississippi that was doing Habitat and that they were one of the few organizations that they found that would welcome small children. She organized a trip to Cahoma for people in our church, and families could go. And that was in 1993. She announced this, and I was thinking, oh, I really want to do this.
New Covenant had an extremely successful first work trip to the Delta. While working on Habitat houses, they began to meet local residents of Cahoma. Bill Sutton remembers his family's introduction to the Delta.
Young guys in the community, they just play ball. That was their community court, and they'd be playing ball. Well, our guys, our little guys, you know, would go out there to watch them play ball, and they were so nice to our guys. I remember this one guy named Daryl who could dunk. He would just stick around afterwards and let Matt throw him alley-oop passes, and he would dunk them for like half an hour straight. They were just really, really welcoming to our kids, and that meant a lot to me. And then the other thing was the potluck. The tradition was at towards the end of the week, the local folks would make food for the volunteers as a way of thanking them for coming. These folks are so hospitable and so welcoming and embracing of us and our kids. I hope y'all come back, and I just didn't expect it. You know, I think those two things between the basketball and the potluck, I just really had the sense that I am welcome, that my presence is not resented, but my presence is actually sort of desired, and sort of let's see what we can do together from here, even if it's playing basketball.
A group from New Covenant returned to Kahoma in 1994, but by 1995, building projects in Kahoma were dwindling, so the group volunteered at another nearby Habitat affiliate, the one started against all odds in Farrell Sherrod. Because they were still participating in the Collegiate Challenge Program, Bill and Jane Sutton recruited several University of Illinois students to join the New Covenant crew. The college students did not quite know what to expect. Laura Curlin recalls her first Habitat trip to Farrell Sherrod in 1995.
It was intergenerational. There were families. So Bill and his wife and his three kids, which they were pretty young at the time, were there. There was one or two other families and then college students. I had never seen anything like that. This was in Farrell Sherrod. I mean, obviously, one of the poorest areas of the country. And I really saw hope. I saw God at work. Amazing things were happening, and it was just a privilege to be a part of it. Experiencing that for the first time, yeah, it was huge, kind of a pivotal point in my life.
God, I wonder what I have done. Lord, it causes grace for
Bill Sutton's enthusiasm for the work of Habitat in the Delta eventually engaged not only college students, but also students at University Laboratory High School, better known as Uni High in Urbana, Illinois. Bill Sutton had been teaching history at Uni since 1992. He recalls how the idea of Uni students serving as Habitat volunteers in the Delta during the annual week of special activities known as Agora Days first emerged.
These two girls came in, Chandra Linton and Sean DeLamar, and they were like, well, why can't we like take Agora Days and go down to Mississippi? You do it with college students, how come you can't do it with high school students? And I was like, never dawned on me. Well, you go check with the administration, see what they say, thinking there's not a snowball's chance in hell this is going anywhere. And they come back, and sure enough, this administrator was like, yeah, that sounds like something we should talk about, you know, as long as there's no proselytizing.
In the spring of 1997, Uni students and chaperones set off for the Delta on their first Habitat work trip. The group stayed at the Habitat Visitor Center in Farrell Sherrod. Laura Koritz, who graduated from Uni in 1998, recalls her first impressions of the Delta.
So Sherrod, it's really rural. There was the dorm and then the row of Habitat houses that we were working on. And then it was maybe four or five houses, and there's this kind of abandoned, derelict, plantation-looking building across the street. But other than that, it's just these red mud roads and fields. And I remember feeling how freeing it felt to be doing something good and to be doing something with my friends and kind of away from my family. It felt so different from any time away from home I had ever spent. It wasn't about sightseeing and it wasn't about going to the museum. It was about helping people and connecting with people.
In 2000, Uni's volunteer crews began working for the Habitat affiliate in Clarksdale, Mississippi. Doug Mina, a Uni teacher and coach who has served as a chaperone on every Uni trip since 1997, explains what it meant to move from Farrell Sherrod to Clarksdale.
Clarksdale's it's a city, you know, it's 17,000 people, so, you know, it's not huge, but it's compared to Farrell Sherrod, yes, there are gas stations, there are convenience stores, there are houses all over the place, so it's a little more urban area. There in Clarksdale at the Habitat dorm, you know, the first time you pull up, a swarm of little kids everywhere, and so I think that was one of the biggest changes. The fact that you would see the condition of some of the housing, you know, there'd be a really nice house, nice in Clarksdale standards, and then next to some house that is just totally dilapidated and falling apart, but there's somebody still living there.
Volunteer work with a Habitat affiliate in Clarksdale has grown since 2000, as groups from East Central Illinois, but also from other places, Chicagoland, Wisconsin, Minnesota, New York, and even Germany, have become committed to doing at least one regular work trip each year. Bob Coverdill, a uni parent who has served multiple times as a construction crew leader, describes the rhythm of these week-long work trips.
So Mondays are always a bit disjointed. You know, we never seem to get much done. We're moving tools around, we're figuring out where stuff's at, and picking up messes from the group before us that didn't leave things in good working order. And we start to get stuff moving, like hanging drywall or doing insulation or starting siding or whatnot. Tuesday starts to become a better day. We get better oiled and start making things happen. Wednesday morning, we only work half day on Wednesdays. We really start rocking things out. And by Thursday, the kids are saying, man, I wish we had another week. We're really getting stuff done. We'd like to keep doing this stuff. But then we try to make sure we're doing things well. And then by Friday, I just stand back and watch because people know what they're doing. And then a Friday night is usually our big closing night, pretty emotional, you know, a lot of raw sharing of things amongst the kids and the sponsors. And then Saturday, up at the crack of dawn and buzz on home, and always have this sense of loss when I get back home because, you know, that feeling of being there together in a week is so special.
However, the uni trips are not solely about construction work. They also involve educational and personal experiences that profoundly impact the student volunteers. Uni teacher Doug Minat emphasizes the educational components of Habitat work trips, as led by Bill Sutton.
Bill, his classroom sessions have morphed a little bit. Depending on what the topic is, what the subject is, you know, all the students that go down there, they pretty much can take over the discussion and, you know, it just rolls. First get into town, he takes the kids on tours through Coahoma County and picks out some, you know, the spots they need to know about, and you do little side trips too. You know, you go to the Emmett Till Museum and Interpretive Center. All the volunteers that live down there, they come in and talk about their role down there, what their motivation was, what keeps them down there, what they're trying to do, what they hope to do, you know.
Uni alumna Helen Miller has also witnessed the ways that working with Habitat in the Delta serves to increase students' awareness of social justice issues.
They all seem so aware of things, like they talk about what they've seen that week and they tie it into what they're learning in history class, and it all just seems very like intelligent for their age. And I'm like, I'm pretty sure I wasn't, you know, that aware of things at 17, so it's neat to see them kind of put that together already.
In addition to broader social understanding, students also have the opportunity to work with construction supervisors who live locally and are essential to the success of the project. Again, Helen Miller.
They're running a Habitat site with volunteers, and there are all these delays with materials not being ready and other subcontractors. Like, they have these really relaxed attitudes, but they're still authoritative in the sense that they have a way they want things to happen, and they make sure that it gets done. But I'm always been very impressed with them and their commitment to their jobs in the community and how much work they have to do both mentally and physically on these job sites.
Construction supervisor J.D. Smith describes his perspective on teaching the young volunteers.
Teaching is fun because you got a question for me while you're out there, I got an answer for you. It's going to be right. Once I tell you, then you still don't know how to do it, then I show you what it is. And I go there and I draw it out for you, write it out. I make your work easier.
I look around and I see my work's not done. And I know I'm here this evening. I know what I'm here to do. Give thanks for the joy of living my life with you. Every day, I give thanks for the joy of living my life with you.
Developing relationships between volunteers and members of the local Habitat community encourages regular return trips. Uni alumna Lula Chen explains the significance of these connections.
If you go into a community and you plop down a house and then you leave, first, there's a good chance that house will just disintegrate because no one cares that much about it. But if you go into a community, you understand and you learn more about that community, about why you're building the house, about the family that's behind the house, going in and learning more about the challenges of the culture or of the community itself. First of all, you're going to build a very different house. And second, the people who are in those houses or who kind of watch this whole thing happen, they're going to care a lot more about that house and also about like the group that came in to build it.
As people of privilege entering a low-income community, it is important for volunteers to build relationships with locals. Bill Sutton emphasizes the value of reciprocity. That is, while students help to improve living conditions by working with Habitat homeowners, they also personally benefit from the experience.
I think we've learned to listen, to pay attention, mm-hmm. to offer what we can offer and receive what we can receive. I really think a huge part of the success of what we do is the fact that we are so conscious of what we are receiving. And it's just that whole reciprocity. We've embraced it, and I think it's really worked.
Bob Coverdill has spent hours working with youth on Habitat construction sites in the Delta, but his memories of one work week are especially vivid. When the volunteers learned about the conditions that the future homeowners were living in, their desire to make visible progress on the house only increased.
We had found out that the couple that were going to live there, their names are Joe and Jesse, at that time they were early 60s. They were living in what I can just describe as a shack, you know, around Champaign-Urbana. If this building was on any city property, it would be condemned. It was just in such bad shape. And so they got the Habitat house going, you know, they got approved for it, but then they'd shut off the water to the well to this house they were living in. So every night, Joe had to go with his car and load up buckets of water from somewhere, bring it so they had water to flush the toilets, shower, bathe, you know, cook, whatever. And we recognized that we just had to try to do something a lot faster. So literally in 5 days with a group of 24 or 5 young people who had virtually no skills, we were able to completely install the siding on the house. And what we found out later was that allowed them to finish the house less than 2 months later rather than 6 months later like was originally planned. And Joe and Jesse were able to move in. She was in what was going to be her kitchen. It looked out across the farm field to the levee for the Mississippi River off in the distance. And I said, you know, what are you thinking of? And she just said, you know, I never in a million years would have dreamed I'd have a place like this. It would be mine. And I just can't even imagine it.
Rob Zitch is a uni alumnus who has also served as a construction supervisor on uni trips to the Delta. He describes his own powerful experience of meeting future homeowners while working on a Habitat house.
We came in, there was a house that had been sitting all winter long with no roof on it. We were going to try to put the roof on, but everybody told us we couldn't do it. And so we all took that to heart and were insulted. And even though all of these students, other than a couple, had never done anything like this before, we put the roof on it. We were putting the last piece of plywood on it and putting felt over it, which weathers it in, keeps it from getting wet anymore. When it started raining on Friday, which was our last work day, and the joy of that was incredible. And the woman and her two sons were there, and she was just so excited that we had gotten that roof on, that her house was now closed in. It wasn't going to rain inside her eventual home anymore.
Uni alumna Laura Curlin recalls the relationship that Habitat volunteers developed with another homeowner.
The homeowner is this really tough guy. The first time we met him, yeah, he was a little gruff. And then just as time goes on, now it's like he's always smiling and making jokes and easy banter. And it just something shifted in him. And he said, I think he said it to Bill, you know, I'm just so surprised that people like you would do something like this for nothing.
There is a low.
While Habitat gives hope to people who have lived in poverty, it also enriches those who participate as volunteers. Seth Curlin is a uni alumnus who has participated in many Habitat work trips. He notes how the deep and obvious faith of many people in the Delta has in turn enriched his own.
One of the things that strikes you so much when you go down into the Delta is the dividing line for the people, and particularly the black folks who have nothing, less than nothing in some cases. You know, it feels like it draws me closer to Christ and draws me deeper in my faith when I see these people who have so much less than I do and have so much more reason to be bitter and cynical and angry and violent even. But because of Christ, they forgive, they work, they rise above the circumstances that the world has dealt them.
UNI alumnus Marshall Alston Yagle also describes how working with Habitat in the Delta has impacted his sense of self.
There's no way that you can go down there and not be benefited by the love and benefited by the wonderful and bizarre experience of working for something other than yourself. I forget who the quote is from, but I heard once, I think it's the unavoidable thing about charity is that one man cannot help another without helping himself. And that's really true because it does bring me so much personal hope and growth and love and development.
This reciprocal growth, the sense of connection and purpose that comes from working side by side with people whose needs are different from your own, has been central to the vision of Habitat for Humanity since its beginning. And for a surprising number of young people who grew up in East Central Illinois with opportunities to go elsewhere, the search for meaning and purpose in life has led them to return to the Mississippi Delta. For some, this has meant repeated Habitat work trips. For others, it has meant taking a gap year working for Habitat or in local schools or in other community development initiatives in the Delta. And for others, it has led to an even deeper commitment to righting the wrongs of the past by settling in the Delta for the foreseeable future and joining efforts to build integrated communities and greater opportunities there. For Bill Sutton, who has devoted countless hours to helping young people understand and find their way in the world, the appeal of the Delta is not surprising.
When they see something, their heart's touched in some way. I think maybe it's partially because the Delta takes them seriously. You know, like you have something to offer. There's this sort of universal hunger that we have for love, for community, for purpose, and for God.
In the next installment of this documentary, we will hear other stories of what can happen when people come together in search of community and purpose.
Shingle by shingle, I'm patching up the roof. Row by row, I'm bringing in the crop. Love makes a change, I'm living the proof. New water's in the well and I'm grateful.
We hope you enjoyed Rebuilding Foundations, Housing and Hope in the Mississippi Delta. The program was produced by University Laboratory High School students Carissa Hu, Anne-Marie Michael, and Andrew Stelzer, with help from Zena Dolan, Callie Bruce, Pomona Carrington-Hextra, Evan Dankovich, Hannah Davis, Catherine Dullerud, Solomia Jaman, Stella Foe, Abraham Hahn, Sara Hasash, Zona Hernyuk, Annika Kimmy, Malika Luther, Nisa Maharani, Betty Wen, Keisha Patel, Rima Reby, Ellen Rispoli, Hadley Shapland, Elizabeth Singer, Ha'il Sun, Natalie Stein, Ariel Summit, Juliana Teritza, Lawrence Teritza, Katie Tender, Maggie Tewksbury, and Anna Rosu. Interviews were conducted by the Uni High Class of 2020 and members of the production team. Stories were contributed by Marshall Alston Yagle, Sharon Bates, Jackie Byes, Lula Chen, Bob Coverdill, Millsap Stye, Mark Foley, Bill Foster, Carl Fuller, James Jackson, Dorothy Jenkins, Aura Lee Johnson, Laura Curlin, Seth Curlin, Laura Koritz, Danielle Miller, Helen Miller, Doug Minot, Otto Prius, Jason Peterson, Bill Sutton, Jane Sutton, Abby Warfel, David Warfel, Patrick Weems, Ben Williams, Willie Williams, Emily Wisseman, and Rob Zitch. The program was directed by University Laboratory High School teacher Janet Morford, with assistance from Kimberly Cronick, Jason Croft, and Steve Mork at Illinois Public Media. For more information on our project, please visit our website at www.unihighoralhistory.org.